netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hello and welcome to FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this episode, Mike Seymour speaks with Betsy Patterson, lead visual effects supervisor on Netflix Stranger Things Season 5, about closing out the show's landmark season. The show has been nominated for Outstanding Special Visual Effects in a Season or Movie for this year's Emmys. Now, Patterson breaks down their doing as much as practically possible philosophy that guided the finale and how that played out across Demogorgon and Demodog's work, on-set reference build, as well as the de-aging of young Will Byers. The conversation also covers the multi-vendor pipeline with Weta FX and ILM as lead studios, the scheduling challenges of matching shots across vendors with the same sequence, and Daly's process that at its peak reviewed over 300 shots in a single day. So let's go ahead and cross that conversation now.
So Betsy, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Good to be here.
Congratulations on the conclusion of what has been an iconic piece of television and of visual effects for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great honor really to work on.
I wanted to pick up on a theme from the show and just basically like center around a concept, which is basically we're not afraid of VFX anymore. I think too much of the industry these days is in a balance between obviously internally we embrace visual effects for everything that it can do and its respect for filmmaking. And then publicly everyone seems to be saying it's all done in camera. You're clearly doing a show that couldn't be done in camera.
Yes.
But talk to me about that line between doing things obviously practically, but of course none of it's real, but doing it practically, I don't use the word real, and where you're seeing the handoff to visual effects.
I just try to be as involved as possible, you know, talking through with the other department heads how to achieve each bit. And, you know, we all start from with the philosophy that we need to do as much real as possible. And the line becomes when it's just not possible anymore. And that kind of bleeds over into things that, you know, yes, the Demogorgon is fully CG, but we work really hard to make sure the stuff that it interacts with, you know, that's a real vase being knocked off a table or you know, dining table pushed over. You know, it's a real stunt guy being pulled on wires, not a CG guy that he's killing. So it's really trying to find the best possible solution for each situation and using visual effects where there's really no other way to get there.
How much is that? I mean, it's obviously a combination of both, but how much is it giving the actors and those that are crafting on set something to actually look at? And how much is it you informing a visual effects team with what would have happened had something remotely like this been able to be possible?
It's really both. We take that very seriously in the visual effects department, in my visual effects departments anyway, to help the actors and the camera guys, especially as much as possible to feel that the thing is really there or really happening. So that's just being as transparent as possible, showing everyone who's willing to look at it the previs, you know, making all kinds of crazy props for them to interact with, whether it's, you know, the perfect kind of sandbag for Karen to stab or, you know, whatever it takes. We work with special effects a lot to do little air blows and little you know, fishing line pulls of things to just really try to make sure that the interaction with the environment is real and that the actors have everything they need to really feel that that creature is there.
I mean, for those that don't know, when did you first get involved with Stranger Things?
I came on for the final season, but, you know, I started as soon as they started having scripts. So in all together, I was on a little over 3 years.
Talk to me about the previs, because that's got to be a pivotal point when visual effects is such a all-encompassing term. There's a lot of no department that doesn't use visual effects. But if you think about sort of visual effects in the broader terms, is influencing those decisions about what the other departments are going to have to do or not do and where you're going to draw the line?
I mean, I think that's why, you know, being on the ground during prep with all of the other department heads is so important. You know, that prep time is just essential for really good visual effects, because we really need to all be agreed on the approach to whatever it is that needs to be done, so that you're getting the best out of each department and each department feels supported by the visual effects, not like, oh, they're just going to take it over and, you know, do what they do. I want them to feel like they were involved in shaping the final result, which they were. It's always better if everyone's on board with what it's going to be and what it's going to look like, and they're helping to the best of their abilities to get there. So Previs becomes very important for that, because it gets everybody, people can weigh in like, oh, hey, I could do that little bit over there. Or, you know, that's going to make it really hard for me. Do you think we could change it so he turns left instead of right? You know, there's all of those conversations that happen with all of the departments, from, you know, hair to costumes to stunts, special effects. You know, we're kind of all in it together, really trying to figure out how as a team to bring it to life.
Let's discuss Vecna as an example of that. Because, I mean, clearly at some point you could say, hey, it'd just be easier to do this entire character CG, because there's no doubt that with the quality of artists you're working with, they could make a character walk and sure. do stuff. And we know that the character has to have, for want of a better term, a live back or a live kind of, you know, body.
His whole body, really.
Yeah.
You can see his blood moving.
So what's the, I mean, obviously it's a shot by shot basis, but what's the sort of thinking there about like how much you're going to just get reference and how much you're going to actually build and connect, and how hard it is actually to track onto the dynamics of a body?
Yeah. I mean, it certainly makes it harder and probably definitely more expensive in the long run to do it the way we did it. But you know, it was really important to everyone that it's Jamie Campbell Bauer's performance, you know, so he was on set in every scene. You know, there's maybe I could count on, you know, one hand, the number of shots where he wasn't involved in some way.
But would it, in your thinking, and I'm talking in broad terms, right, but would it not be Jamie's performance if he'd been in a mocap suit and providing the performance decisions that way?
I mean, at least the Duffer's philosophy and my philosophy too is that it's kind of a little less dynamic and cohesive if he's, you know, he needs to kind of be there in the, you know, we dressed him even in a Lycra kind of simulation of what the final makeup would be, rather than putting him through the full body stuff. It would have been more efficient if he'd been in a full mocap suit, but this way he didn't look goofy when he walked onto set. He looked scary. And that was really important to us, to have all of the actors and everyone react to him as if he, you know, he is in his final look. So having, you know, we used as much of the practical face makeup from Barry Gower as we could, but even the rest of the body, it's sort of diminishing returns. If we had gone with a full mocap suit, the fear was that people wouldn't have taken him as seriously. He wouldn't have felt as comfortable getting into character. It just wouldn't have been as scary.
I understand Jamie even had things like pads under his arms to help him kind of seem a bit, which is a really interesting addition from the wardrobe department to inform an actor without having, but then of course you've got a visually effects deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's the trade-off, that, yeah, we had to paint out most of his body, all of his body really in every shot. But, you know, the pads in particular were his idea, because he really, when he put on the Lycra suit, he's like, oh, I feel a little too skinny. Like, and he saw our animation tests of, you know, the body and how broad those shoulders were. He's like, okay, well, I want to feel that a little bit more. So can you do something for me here? And so we came up with the pad idea. And I think costumes built it, or Barry might have built the first pass of them. But that just kind of gave him, it made him feel more like he had the stance of the look of the character.
And then, of course, there's going to be a bunch of shots where there's wire work and rigs and safety harnesses and everything else. So there's a whole lot of reasons why you've got a kind of body double, but then still maintain that, as you say, the underlying performance, I guess, that his decisions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they, you know, there were very few times when he didn't just get in the rigs himself. You know, I think there were a couple of scenes where he's just kind of hanging from the ceiling for a very long time, looking like he's asleep. So I think they had to stand and do that part. But anytime he's awake, that's him in the rigs, chained to the ceiling, you know, trying to look like he's floating there. It ends up being a lot of paint out, but it gives everyone a very solid point of reference for what the shot really is. You know, a lot of times when you're saying, oh, we'll do the whole thing CG, you're starting from nothing. So it actually makes the effects harder in a lot of ways, because you have to go through all of the creative decisions that would be made on set if you really attempt to get as close as you can, even if you're going to have to replace every pixel.
So combining those two concepts we just talked about, the previews, and then obviously respecting the actor's ability to make acting choices, you've got naturally, of course, especially in the final episode, you've got a lot of occasions where actors are working in spaces that are going to be extended, that are going to be changed by visual effects naturally for the environment. You've got previews where you're blocking those things out, but where people stand in shot and what they choose to do and how they choose to look are acting choices. So I'm just wondering, like, how close did you block motion and how much did you end up saying, okay, well, this is kind of roughly vaguely what's going on, but until we actually get in whatever partial set we're in, we're not going to know which way the actors are going to move. So we really don't know how we're going to solve these problems.
We laid it out as much as we could. Obviously, like in the final battle, the actors are going to run the way they're going to run. And, you know, they do, I think, respect the storyboards and previs, though, as they go into the scene and as they talked about it with the Duffers, because they know that's the Duffers' choices going into that previs and storyboard. So they kind of, I think they're grateful for it, really, because they know, like, oh, the monster's there, you know, and that's how big it is, and that's what we will look like running forward. So, you know, the kind of little, the smaller choices are very flexible, but the larger choices, like you've got to run in this direction, you know, left past camera, that's the stuff that we kind of have to stick to, just to make sure that, you know, we can really put the monster in there in a believable way.
So when you've got that epic scale, what are they working off? Because clearly, I mean, you know, they're on a stage. Are they working off just seeing a physical storyboard like a picture that's a still, or are you showing them videos, or do you have any kind of elaborate system to kind of inform them as to eye lines and things?
We had a kind of augmented reality system that you could look at through an iPad. So you could always look at the creature through the iPad and kind of hold it up and see, like, oh, wow, he's that tall. And that helped camera especially, so that they could know, they could kind of make their markers, like, oh, he's going to be by that tree over there. So we were shooting in a quarry with a bunch of blue screen. That was the main thing. We would kind of rehearse each little beat ahead of time and kind of get them used to where the monster was. We also had special effects do little sand poofs on the ground, like where its feet were supposed to be hitting.
Those things were, yeah.
So that they really kind of felt that pressure behind them.
That mean that the production design, I mean, obviously you didn't need final visual effects, but production design was pretty much nailed down in what things were going to look like so that you would have that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Yeah, we started very early on that scene so that we could figure out the geography, because it was based on a real canyon in New Mexico, but shooting there would have been very difficult because I think it was a protected land. But also we wanted to be able to shape the environment to fit the action that we needed to happen there. So we kind of mapped it all out, and Weta really helped us kind of get some overhead views and say, like, okay, we need, you know, there's a walk and talk over here, so this section needs to be this long. And, you know, we knew exactly what all the geography was in the previs stage, and that made it possible that when we got to the quarry, really all that was there at the quarry was the rocky ground. So we were able to kind of do the cheats we needed to make production go faster and not have to walk a full mile and shoot them doing the walk and talk. We could kind of repeat the background since there was just blue screen behind them, but we still knew where they were in space.
So in that setting, you've got a pretty clear idea of a lighting design because it's a, well, I was going to say natural, it's not a natural environment, you know what I mean? Like it's a, not a man-made
We had made decisions on the lighting,
Yeah. But there's a lot of sequences in here where you're in a, I'm going to say a man-made or industrial setting, and annoyingly, those lights flicker. I'm just wondering, like, what is the approach to that? Because it is a mind-numbing problem to me to try and get that in sync. And you don't even know what the edit's going to be, and the edit alone could throw the lighting.
I mean, luckily, the flashing lights that happened anytime there was a Demogorgon were so chaotic that we didn't have any trouble kind of trying to match the lighting on a cut because it was always so flickery that shot to shot, we didn't have to worry about that too much. But the you know, the vendors had a hell of a time matching the overall look of it. You know, they had to kind of plot out exactly where each one of those flickering lights was so that, you know, it would feel seamless on the CG creatures.
Right. And so if the script calls for actor is being strangled from behind inside glass lab with lots of glass, are you saying, look, let's just not put the glass in, we'll add it later because this is gonna be a nightmare for reflections and stuff? Or are you just
honestly, yeah, the day I walked onto that set and saw the first lighting test, it's like oh no. And there were even other scenes as simple as like the DJ booth and the radio station is a full glass box. So yes, we had to make sure that all of the glass was removable if necessary. All of it could kind of gimbal just a little bit. So if there was a way to keep it in and just tweak it a touch, we could do that. So there was a lot of back and forth on that. But yeah, we were having that discussion before every shot. Should we leave the glass in or should we take the glass out?
I mean, what you just touched on there, I think is a brilliant example that I think is worth unpacking a little bit. Just that simple fact that production design will build things so that they can tilt glass so that you don't have to just keep on piling on visual effects to solve reflections.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not cheap necessarily, but it's cheaper than just having to solve everything. But it certainly shows doing that on the day is incredibly time consuming and almost impossible. Doing it in advance just shows good production design.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of the advantage of having a team like this where the production designer had been with the show from the beginning and kind of had learned the hard way what happens when you don't plan ahead like that. And there was a lot of kind of willingness this season to do those plans and to be cooperative about it and to talk through like, well, is this really going to be cheaper if we do it now or will it be cheaper if we just do it in post? We had those conversations kind of whenever anything came up. And there was a nice quality of collaboration from everybody because, you know, I was new to the show, but everybody else had been really through, you know, one disaster after another, really complicated stuff that blew up on them and, you know, stuff that they pulled off in a beautiful way in the end, but they were all willing to, you know, let's have a little less stress and plan for this ahead of time because we all know it's going to happen if we don't.
Let's just digress for a second. I wasn't going to go there, but now you brought it up. I think it's really interesting. That collaboration we always talk about with production design, for example, we tend to think of in practical terms like reflections, but there's an enormous collaboration between the producers of those departments. Maybe you could just talk about that because it's not just a matter of is it cheaper? It's like how feasible it is, how much risk there is, and also how much time it's going to take and how much it's going to throw the actors by doing things an odd way or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the stuff that just comes with the experience. You know, you have a gut instinct for, you know what, I'm going to give up on this one and just not push for, you know, the blue screen over there that I really wanted because I can see that's going to set them back an hour and they're already late because of that. So, you know, it's always a bargaining process on the day on set. So, you know, you try ahead of time to plan as much as possible and to, you know, request all the things that you need. If you're working with collaborative other department heads, they let you know ahead of time as much as they can if they're really not going to be able to provide that or that's going to kill their time frame. But sometimes, you know, everyone's willing, but just the day is not going well, and you have to bite the bullet and just say, okay, we'll deal with it in post.
So let's go back to Vecna for a second, because we talked about, you know, him in basically a version of the costume, but there are some shots where he's got dots on him. There are some shots mm-hmm. where he's got sort of things on his back that are quite substantial. I mean, are
those
you
were never
also? Sorry.
The things on his back were never real.
No, sure. But there were, you know, elements that are literally green elements that are clearly for visual effects to reference off
rings
and stuff.
And stuff, yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, there's another negotiation or at least collaboration between you and a vendor visual effects supervisor, because in one sense, they're thinking, I got to bring this in on time and on budget. They're trying to negotiate how far they can, you know, in a positive way, influence you to stop everything and stick more dots on, and how much you're going to be like, no. The guy.
It's a very good point. You know, I was lucky enough with Vecna to be working with Martin Hill at Weta, and he just really collaborated and communicated every step of the way. And we talked about exactly that at the beginning when we were kind of planning it out. You know, we had a full year of prep on this show, so we were really able to talk through all of the issues. And yes, of course, they would much rather we had Vecna in a full mocap suit, even with a head rig on him and cameras pointed at his face. But, you know, the Duffers were very clear how much they were willing to give up on set, how much they weren't. So we were able to talk to Weta and just say, look, you know, we know you would love this stuff, but what's the minimum you could take? And that's what we ended up with, where we just had these very simple dots that gave them kind of just enough that they could grab on.
Yeah. I mean, again, sometimes it's portrayed as being a in-conflict discussion between how much we'll tolerate on set and how much whatever. But of course, the Duffer brothers want nothing better than the final shot to be jaw-droppingly great. So they've got a vested interest themselves in balancing their own requirements, what they want on set.
Exactly,
And pulling it off.
I mean, I think if they had their druthers, Jamie would not have had the pads or the dots, and he would have been in full makeup. But, you know, that they realized, because they had done that the season before, he was full makeup, and it was 8 to 9 hours in the chair every day. And they realized that was compromising their time on set. So they kind of learned how to, you know, where the line should be. Like, okay, we can handle 2 hours of Jamie and makeup every day, but 8 hours is too much. So, you know, we kind of talked with Barry about what he could do in that amount of time. But it's for Weta, they just are so experienced with this stuff. They know where those lines are, and they know what they can solve without having the top of the line stuff. But there were other scenes, for instance, young Will at the very opening scene.
Well, I was
where
I was,
they were like, "Look, we have to have those cameras. We have to have them." And the Duffers were willing to accept it. Like, okay, we'll do it. We know it. We know we have to make it work.
I was holding Will back to the last thing I wanted to discuss, just because that's my favorite. But before we just get there, I was wondering for you personally, because we're discussing this notion of like various things that are not in conflict, but you're trying to balance out. You've got something like the Demogorgons, which we've seen in all the seasons, yeah? That's just like well understood. Mm-hmm. How much for you is there a temptation personally to put your own signature on maybe doing something with them that hasn't been done before, or in something that you always thought, oh, it'd be a bit better if they were a bit slimier or a bit like whatever. And how much are you like, no, the Bible has been written by the first four seasons. We will stick to it and replicate.
You know, it's the Duffers are really great to work with in that way because they want to plus it. You know, they don't want it to
but
be
you're
exactly
an artist in your own right. You haven't.
Well,
no,
sure,
I mean,
yeah.
You're being very modest.
I mean, there were definitely things where I'm like, well, you know what? I don't really like the way that the shoulders and the hips moved last season. So let's go in there and see if we can fix that up. And, you know, some of the muscle sims and some of the, just some of the kind of the way he ran, the way the Demogorgon runs. You know, we kind of started from scratch on that and did a lot of work redesigning how that run works. So we just knew we were going to be seeing so much more of these creatures. So even though we have seen them and we know what they look like, we're going to be putting them through much more paces in this season. So, you know, everyone was open to like, well, you know, as long as it's not an instantly like, oh, he looks different, as long as it's the polish, they kind of let me do what I thought was needed.
If we leave out scenes like the end D&D around the in the basement type of thing, audiences aren't seeing sort of 2015 cut to 2026. They've just got a notion in their heads of what a character was like. And so if we go for those characters that are obviously in action sequences, which are new and different than they've obviously the script has called for, technology has shifted in like the 10 years. I mean,
yeah,
you can it's do true. More and do better. Why not, kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so if we can get nicer looking subsurface in the skin and better slime, and you know, let's really go for it and have a lot of slobber come out when he screams. You know, all of that, I think everyone was very into kind of adding the polish that's more possible now than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there's a subset of diehard fans that are going to pick apart everything. But I mean, most of the audience, myself included, aren't reacting to the subsurface scattering on a scare moment like that. We're trying to like leap off the back of the couch.
No, but you know, if it helps him feel like he's really in the room, that's yeah. worth it. You know, it's if Vecna, if you can really just feel Vecna's toes in the gross carpet in that house, that helps the scare, really.
Okay, so let's get to Will. So it's 2.5 years since season 4. You're new on the block and you're going to open with a flashback where everybody's going to be paying attention because we're trying to get back into the story. And you're leaping off with a really demanding piece of visual effects acting, if I can call it that. Boy, you didn't like come to work with a... without your coffee that morning.
It was, I put all of the kind of big challenges of the show on a list for the Duffers when I kind of first went through the scripts, and they were like, okay, you know, what do you think? What should we be worried about? Young Will was always at the top. That, to me, that was like, we need to make sure as far ahead of time that we have this solved, because otherwise it's going to open the whole season with a bad taste in people's mouths.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was so important that work. So that's what we threw ourselves into first. And, you know,
if you've got a close up of Will, there is literally nowhere else the audience is looking, but
exactly.
right at your visual effects. If so, exactly. 17 soldiers are surrounding someone and there are explosions going off and one reflection in one windshield isn't there, who cares? No one's going to notice it. I mean, someone might on a podcast, but like literally who cares? But on those sequences, it's not just does it look seamless. It's is it the right sort of performance, like the actual acting choices.
Absolutely. I mean, it that was so important. It had to feel like Noah. So, you know, we kept him involved along the way and made sure that he, you know, got to talk to the young stand-in actor, and you know, we did film him kind of pretending to perform the scene, sitting in a chair. It's tough though, because he's, you know, he's so much older now. I don't think even he reacts the same way that he would have when he was 10. So, you know, there's a lot of subjectivity in it. There's a lot of back and forth. So it was really down to the Duffers and all of us kind of looking
How
at stuff.
How old was the stand-in?
Does it feel like him? He was that age. He was okay. 10 or 11. Yeah.
So then you're demanding a lot from a young child, like a young actor.
Right? Oh, very much. Yeah. And so Noah was there on the set and he would talk to him before each take. And, you know, they would really try to mind meld and try to kind of feel like he was giving that performance. And he did have dots all over his face as well. But we, you know, the hope was to not have to change the performance at all. But of course, there's always there's minute facial expressions, little eye things that, like, you know what, it just doesn't feel like Will yet. You know, we've got to tweak that just a little bit more. So yeah, it took a while, but I was pretty happy with it in the end.
Can you unpack your thought processes as a supervisor? Was it, I guess I should ask this firstly, was it deemed that there was going to be a way that you were going to do that, that somebody had decided when writing it, or was it like up to you, like, we want to do this, you have no idea how to, hey Betsy, how are you going to pull this off?
Yeah, it was the second one.
Okay.
Which was the other reason it was at the top of my list of things to worry about.
So what was your thought processes, because you had a number of ways you could go there, from sort of AI face swapping to full CG?
Yeah, so you know, I called our buddies at both ILM and Weta, and we had really long discussions about pros and cons and various approaches. And I talked to the Devers a lot about, you know, the kind of trade-offs. Like, if we decided to go all AI, some shots might look better, but you're not going to have control. And they like to be able to do their tweaks. And, you know, there's just a small, like, they want to pull that one hair there, you know. And you can't ask AI to do that. It re-renders the whole thing. So in the end, we decided that the safer route was traditional CG, but we wanted to make sure that we gave Weta as much information as possible. So their biggest wish was as many witness cams as possible. We had rigs attached to the main picture camera. They sent a supervisor here for those weeks when we were shooting that, so that they could really make sure that they were getting the data that they needed to pull it off, because you have to be able to lock that in just to the slightest pixel.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. I mean, obviously, Weta's incredibly talented at doing so, but I mean, a blue avatar character is blue, and we don't know what that skin tone looks like, so I just go with
it. Exactly. Exactly.
This is a well-known character with incredibly sort of youthful, supple skin that's going to have a lot of incredible response to light. And you're in major close-ups.
Yeah.
And just even their eyeballs and what's going on with their eyes is immensely difficult. And quite frankly, there's been a few attempts at that over time where, of course, the technology has been pushed as far as it could possibly get. But even with the best artists in the world, it still felt, well, it just, I think it looks good. It just looks fake, or at least it looks like it's artificial.
It's still tough to pull off.
Really, really tough.
Yeah. The toughest thing, I think. Yeah.
You had a test done, didn't you, by Weta, where there was a sort of a side-by-side between an actual shot. And could you talk about that?
Yeah. We took basically every scrap of footage that we could find from season one, you know, including other takes, outtakes, press footage, press interviews, anything we could find. And we sent that all to Weta, and their kind of R&D and test case was doing side by side and actually challenging us to pick which one was real. And there, you know, there were a couple we could tell, but there were a couple where we could not figure out which one was the original.
Betsy, how hard was it to zero in on what that was? Like, from the outset, was it hard to pick, or was it like you know, 28 versions in, then you couldn't pick it?
It took a while. You know, it did take a while. But I think,
was there any aspects of that that you felt was really like when you got the eyes right or whatever, that was when you felt like you'd nailed it?
Yeah. I mean, the eyes, they seem to nail the eyes pretty early. For me, it's always around the mouth. There's just kind of particulars about how human mouths move that CG is always a little bit, that's always where I see it, right here. I don't know what it is, whether it's the tiny little muscles in your face or, you know, that's the toughest thing for me. And every time I've done this kind of work, that's where it breaks for me. So when they got to that point where they could, you know, luckily he doesn't actually talk that much in this scene, but in the, I think it was one of the earlier shots when he's singing, when they nailed that one, I was like, okay, I think we're going to be okay.
So that must have been very tightly previous, because even at a budgeting level, that's like a nightmare to make that kind of work. How long did you have in terms of from we discussed sort of like planning it, but like now you've got the young actor and you've shot them. How long between that and you having to turn over and deliver shots?
I kind of pushed them to edit that scene as soon as we shot it. So, you know, the editor put it together like the next week or two. I mean, I think maybe they had a few weeks with it. You know, and of course we were still shooting, so the Duffers didn't have a lot of time to mess with the cut. So luckily the editor is one they work with on everything. So they have a really good communication, and he had been involved in the previs as well. So everyone knew what to expect and kind of it fit in to the template. So I think within maybe 2 months after we shot it, we were able to turn over shots to Weta.
How many actual?
I think we kind of shared with them, even the rough cuts we shared with them, so they kind of knew what was coming.
How many actual full de-aging shots did you end up there within episode one? And was that, did that change? Did you like lose any shots in a final tweak or anything? Or was it just the cut was the cut?
The cut was the cut. I mean, I think we had a couple added.
Oh, really?
in the final cut, I think. Yeah, it was just like a pacing thing. They wanted to extend that moment at the top of the tree a little more. So we got a couple of extra tight close-ups.
Actually, awesome. I think that's the curse of visual effects, isn't it? Like they go, oh, you can do it. Oh, well, if you can do that, then why don't we do this as well? And you're like, no. Exactly. It's almost like, don't show them the good ones until you run out of time because you're only going to get more. The top of the tree shots, that I mean, the jump
so
stuff
there,
is
there
the stuff that goes.
There were a couple of extra shots in there that were not planned for that Weta was able to pull off because they had done the rest. But overall, I think it was somewhere in the range of 40 shots.
Because I'm going to say the jump shot where he's jumping is the shot that, and you know, it's like very dramatic. But for me, it's the super close up looking down at the realization of what's below when the camera isn't moving, there is no action. And it's just like the horror realization on the face kind of stuff. That's there's nowhere to hide.
Those were the hardest. Yeah. Those were the very last final. That's for sure. You know, the jumping is great, but you know, the jumping is practical. We had a practical stunt woman who is very small and she went up and she did all the jumps. She fell. That fall is all real. He does not have a CG body in that whole scene.
Oh, really?
It's only the CG head. Yeah.
Really? Because also there's motion blur. There's all sorts of marvelous things that help you and you don't get when he's just looking from the top of the tree down. And then was there anything with the mouth feeding implant, you know, like the tentacle where he's at the end unconscious? Yeah. Did that pose any additional problems or was that because of CG on CG?
Well, no, I mean, we gave, because we figured we'd have to come up with some kind of practical way for the kid actors to feel this. So we kind of made a little scuba, you know, a scuba mouthpiece kind of thing that so they could have something that they could feel in their mouths. Because in the end of the scene or the end of the show, all 12 of the kids have the same thing in their mouth. We shot it with pulling the practical thing out of Luke, who's the stand-in's mouth. And then, honestly, that's one of my favorite shots. I think they just did such a beautiful job on his skin and his, the sweat and grime on his face. It really, really turned out to work. But the action is what we shot on set.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, I'm wondering because it's such an environmentally lit solution, and that lighting is kind of, it's pretty ambient in some respects, but it's very colored and stuff.
Yeah.
Was there much work that you did in the grade? Because no matter how great the visual effects work is, we're always expecting a grade after it. And did that move much from your, or was your approval at a dailies already with such a sort of temp grade that it like matched already what was going to be the final?
We had a temp grade. They did push it much further once the colors got in. But again, because this is such a big show, the colorist was involved much earlier. So I was able to sit with them on most of these scenes, you know, pretty early on. And we'd kind of, I was able to see where he was going to go with it and how far off of our, you know, neutral he was going to push it. So, you know, where we could, we'd get examples for the vendor to see. It's always hard to get the color back up the pipe rather than down the pipe, you know, from the colorist back to the vendor. It's always tough to get quality reference in that direction.
A vastly different LUT can show up things that just...
Oh, huge.
That was working, and now you put this LUT on, and now the skin doesn't seem to match.
Oh, well, believe me.
So getting that is pretty important, I imagine.
That's what I spend a lot of time on in post, yeah. Luckily, our offices were in the same building as the colorist, so I could just run upstairs and look at stuff, and he would call me and say, I don't know if this is looking the way you want it to look, and I'd run up there. You know, we could tweak things.
To that end, like a colorist these days can do, you know, through sensible use of AI, can just say, oh, give me the a depth map around that face, and I'm just going to change the lighting on that. And while that's obviously if what the directors want, that's great. But by the same token, like you'd really want to know that stuff as early as possible. And having that twisted in the final grade can be like a nerve-wracking process for a supervisor.
Yes. I mean, I think every supervisor I know goes through this kind of love-hate relationship with the colorist because of that. So I really just make a huge effort to be on the same page and make sure that they're talking to us. And, you know, I'll go up there and they'll say, can I have a map for this? And I'll say, you know what? We have plenty of time. So why don't we just make that change for you? And then I'd rather re-deliver the shot than have him do it. Of course, it happens all the time that they just we're out of time and he has to just use a mat. But
in the old days, they had primaries.
I try to kick it back.
In the old days, they had, you know, primaries and secondaries, and they could only do so much damage, as it were, to a visual effect shot. These days, they can twist it so far, which I know, you know, is like obviously driven by the director. It's not an arbitrary thing. And yet, you really would like to be informed of those things because they can make really subtle differences.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just try to force my way in there as much as I can so that I'm in the loop on those things.
Yeah, which does stretch you fairly thin, I guess, in some respects. I mean, did you end up spending like half your time just in dailies and revisions, or did you get a chance to kind of get with people? And
I would say, you know, most of the time is dailies, yeah. And we would do dailies twice a day and look at however many shots. I think we kept track because we were trying to see how many we could do in a day. I think there was one day we did over 300 shot reviews, which is a lot. You know, sometimes you're just looking at a whole scene that has 20 shots, and, you know, but that was most of the time. And then we would just sit in the dailies room, and then I'd get a call like, hey, can you run up to color? You know, two or three times a week, we would sit with the duffers for a couple hours and look at progress of everything.
And to that end, it must be difficult for you when you're doing that with two vendors on the same sequence, like in some of the fight sequences or the compound kind of thing.
The Maxi battle. Yeah.
Yeah. You've got two really good vendors, no question about it, except for, of course, they're different teams, right? And you have to make sure that from shot to shot, as a scene progresses, it works rather than just this shot is really cool and won't it look good on my showreel?
Yeah. And, you know, it's tough. I hate sharing stuff that way. And I try not to, but every now and then there's a scene like that where there's just no choice. You've got to have multiple vendors on it. So it's the scheduling is one of the hardest things because one vendor's like already and okay, we're finaling our bit. And I'm like, no, you can't final yours because they haven't even started theirs. You know, and they have to work together. We have to like see that fire reflected in his eyes. So there was a lot of kind of jockeying going on. A lot of, you know, we would set up little arbitration calls between the vendors to solve problems.
I mean, I guess the whole industry is used to having multiple vendors on a show and everybody is coming at it from a very collaborative point of view. But nevertheless, it is tough to be like, you need your shots to look like their shots because they just came up with a good idea.
Yeah. There was definitely one case of that where, you know, the one of the vendors, I won't say which is which, but one of the vendors had put in, we were waiting for the other vendor to supply a fire, you know, a big kind of fire aftermath thing. And the other vendor, since they needed it reflected, just did a temp one. And the Duffers liked theirs better. So we had to go back to the first vendor and say, can you do it like this? But, you know, for the most part, it went pretty well because, yeah, both of those vendors just have so much experience doing that.
I'm sure there's no vendor in the world, no supervisor in the world that hasn't been stitched up by a director falling in love with a temp.
You know, I'm from the vendor, you know, my background is from the vendor side. So I have every sympathy for the vendors on this stuff. And, you know, I really try to make it as easy as I can for them.
Just for the purposes of honoring those vendors, who were your primary vendors? Who were you using on the show?
Weta and ILM were the primaries. Weta did most of the creature work, and Vecna, Demogorgons, Demodogs, all of the Abyss battle with the giant Mind Flayer and Vecna's Lair. That was all Weta and Young Will. Many other things. ILM had about a similar size chunk. They did some Demogorgons, but they did a lot of environments. They did the destruction of the Upside Down. They did the big fleshy wall, the vine around Hopper's neck, that scene.
The scene we were referring to earlier with the reflection.
Exactly.
Poor Hopper
exactly.
Getting strangled. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a tough one. So yeah, they were our two, you know, main vendors, but we also used Eyeline, formerly Scanline, Rodeo to the scene, Big Hug. Let's see, I'm sure I'm forgetting people. Bot did a lot of our cleanup and wire removal.
Did you have any team in a house, just your own sort of?
We had one artist who I've okay. known for years, and he does the work of two or three at least. But yeah, it's always good to have at least one person in your back pocket.
Yeah. You just want this little thing tweaked here, or somebody wants to look at something. And yeah. You
know the yard. The yard did a big chunk too.
Yeah. Plus, where were you physically based in the world? Because you're also juggling time zones, right, with these multiple vendors.
Yeah. And none of them are in LA. Yeah, we were in LA. Okay. For post and
Weta is naturally in New Zealand.
We worked, our supervisor at ILM was in Sydney, so a lot of our calls were there. I think Weta had a second team in Vancouver, so they had time zone issues between themselves. And I think ILM also had some teams in various places. So
Sydney and New Zealand aren't too bad, right? That's like LA after lunch.
Yeah, exactly. So that's not so bad.
But yes,
endless hours of Zoom calls and trying to figure out what time it is in the other place.
Yeah. Well, look, congratulations on, such an amazing body of work. And I mean, we could have gone into any one of these scenes for like an hour because they're all fascinating.
There was a lot.
It's the huge variety of shots as well as the number of them that I think is to be applauded, and just how well you finish them, especially that young Will scene, which I just was really leaning into. So
I'm glad you liked it.
No, that was jaw-droppingly good work. So brilliant. Yeah. Congratulations, and thanks again for talking to us about it.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks so much, Betsy, for joining us here on the FX Podcast and diving into the work done on this series. It's been a favorite of mine over the years, and this year was no exception. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening to or watching this FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.